Great, so we're gonna do a little tasting of the four wines of the Lewis Martini portfolio. The first wine is the Griffin. And the Griffin is effectively our new benchmark Cabernet. It is a blend, and it really kind of is a signal of the new direction that we're taking as a winery. So to talk about the Griffin, I think you have to go back maybe about 8 to 10 years and really start to get into the history of like this, of where Martini used to be. You know, we had had price points that range from sub 10 all the way to $250. But a lot of it living in a commercial side around Sonoma, Alexander Valley, Napa Valley. And the decision was made about 10 years ago to start to divest out of those interests and really focus on Napa and Cabernet. So the stat I like to tell everybody is 10 years ago, we were probably making somewhere between 450 to 475,000 cases of wine with the name Lewis M. Martini on it. This past year, 2025, we made about 12,000 cases. Massive change and a signal to market of where we're going. So like I said, the Griffin is really kind of that first wine to hit market to tell that story. But it wasn't just simply about reduction of volume. It was also really a change in style. And so in many ways, what we did is we went back in time. We went back to the wines that Louis P. Martini made famous in the 60s and 70s for their ageability and kind of that point of view around what we call classic Napa. So with that, that meant that Zach Watkins, our winemaker, basically brought a new approach to the style, but also to our sourcing. Zach?
For sure. And I think for me, what's super important is understanding the philosophical differences here on where it's, instead of chasing a style, right, we're more inspired by those decades of the 60s and 70s. And how can we use that inspiration to create a future for Martini? Because of course we're in a different time and place now. And so the way that I approach that is from a proper food culture point of view, which is to say, how do I craft something that fits within the Napa Valley culture of wine, culture of place? And to do that, you have to entirely change how you think about wine. It changes it from a commodity into a piece of food culture and art, therefore art, and inspired by these other regions, just like the great artists of old, right? Who apprenticed with these crazy, extremely talented artists. And so that was my inspiration to kind of figure out where to go in the future. And so for Griffin, what that means is, in practice, we're making small batch, properly crafted expressions of Cabernet, all over sourced all throughout Napa Valley. We're kind of anchored in the southern reaches. That way we can stay a little bit more in tune with higher acidity, more fragrance, more botanicals, and kind of a firmer mouthfeel. And then from there, I'm crafting layers. So everything comes into the winery in a small open top fermenter, 1.5 ton up to 7 ton. Everything's done by hand. Every block gets its own fermenter, gets its own set of barrels or casks, and we're building up this volume from these small parts. And that's really crucial because it captures really unique and elegant expressions of every single vineyard we're working with, as opposed to just one size fits all for fermentation or mixing blocks together. And so building layers that way, I think, is one of the best ways to craft this sort of flagship point of view in Napa Valley, where we're not making it all from a single vineyard, right? And what that means, of course, is part of that interpretation of this older style is the classic pursuit of balance. And so I am looking at, how do I balance these botanicals with the fruit that Cabernet has? How do I use the oak as supportive as opposed to dominant? How do I create a longer plateau of aging with higher acidity and firmer tannins? That therefore helps you drive the table discussion, right? This wine is meant to bring the community back together. We've sort of lost that connection as of late, and so that this wine should help as that conversation starter to get people back together around the table. So that's kind of the philosophy around the Griffin as it stands today.
Yeah, and so the Griffin, year by year, will always change because it really depends on what came in, how those lots kind of developed, and the nuance of what that year gave us. So this will always have blenders, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Malbec, and will vary in shades. With our 2023 vintage, we started incorporating our estate vineyard, Monte Rosso, into that because we felt it was important to the story and also, honestly, to the style, because Monte Rosso is always presented in this very elegant, pretty, perfumed kind of way that we thought would help accentuate that story. So that is the Griffin. It's really kind of the first thing kind of hitting market that really signals this new direction that Zach's taking the wines. The next two wines we have are both from Monte Rosso. So Louis Martini builds the winery in 1933, right at the end of Prohibition. In fact, this building was, he made the wine before Prohibition was fully repealed. Yeah. And so that way he was ready with wine to go. He started purchasing grapes from Monte Rosso in 1934 and then was able to purchase the vineyard in 1938. So this next wine is our Zinfandel. It's old vine. It's part of the original plantings from the 1880s and 90s. So this is roughly 135 to about 138-year-old vine Zinfandel. Zach, talk to us a little bit about the vine itself and then also kind of the approach on this.
So I do love this wine, and I think Zinfandel has had a really storied past in California. There's nothing else like this in the world, in the sense that there's no other food that we mess with that is identifiable from genetic material that we've worked with for hundreds of years, right? Everything's really changed. And that's crazy to think that the decisions made 140-ish years ago are still being employed today. And so to lean into that, what we do source some of the more personality-driven blocks off of Monte Rosso. There's a fair bit of acreage up there planted to the old vines of Zinfandel. And these blocks have perhaps slightly higher percentages of the field blend identity. So as you walk through block 33, there's Karen Young in that block. Block 47 has a lot of Alicante Boucher and Grand Noir in it. There's a little bit of Merlot in block 45. And so as you see these kind of scattered personalities in these blocks, that adds to great character. And so we vinify everything separately in its own tank, and we co-ferment all the varieties, pick them all together, including some whites. And the intention there is just to kind of capture those decisions made. So we're not trying to sort much out. We're not trying to manipulate into something what we think it is today. As such, that means that this wine will be, fragrant forward. It's more about these complexing non-fruit characters that you get from a lot of the field blend stuff with the core fruit. And then I've started more recently only aging the wine in puncheon. So that's about a 2-barrel equivalent. And that kind of slows the aging down. It's like a magnum, right? Slows the aging down, allows the wines to very slowly progress through maturation before bottling, and keep them super fragrant. And that also means reducing the oak both in style, so more kind of lighter toasts, but also in amounts. We're not 2/3, 3/4 new. We're only about 1/3 new now. And I think that helps really capture that terroir-driven essence of Zinfandel off Monte Rosso.
Yeah, I always kind of describe this wine as, again, a little bit like our philosophy in general, a bit of a throwback wine. It reminds me of Zin from the 70s, that like Ridge and early Segacio and, you know, Ravenswood as he moved in, you know, later, that really were elegant. And it really reminds you that this was the original steakhouse wine. Like this wine, you know, I was just in market and had some people, old school Italian, that was like, this is like the best Primitivo I've had in years. You know, so it has this kind of elegance to it that was really amazing. So that's this wine. The next wine, so back to 1938, there's a lot planted up on Monte Rosso. And I always kind of say, I don't know what these crazy guys were thinking about. There were two grocers from San Francisco and they were like, let's go buy 500 acres of land up on the top of this mountain over the fog line. Let's clear it. Let's bring all the material, let's plant it, then let's bring all the water necessary to plant these grapes in the 1880s and 90s. It's insane. It's unbelievable that they did it. But the one thing they didn't plant was Cabernet. So there was no Cabernet when Martini purchased this in 1938. So Martini's planted it starting in 1940. So this is the Monte Rosso Cabernet. This is has and will always have like from original block, and from which is 86-year-old vine, Cabernet, which is from our understanding the oldest in California, which effectively makes that probably North America. And then off of the main block, there were three Maison selections that came off. There were effectively everything's just kind of called Los Niños. And again, a fascinating kind of example of old vine, terroir driven, and really kind of, I think it shows so much of that high iron soil on the cabs, a little bit more than the Zins, with that finish. And I'll let you kind of talk about the make of this grape and the, yeah.
Yeah, what's fascinating about these old blocks is this is the true kind of like history of winemaking, right? It's like there were no nursery idea of going to a shop to pick out a plant to plant thousands of miles away was not the standard until very recently. And so the concept that this is what was happening for hundreds of years in Burgundy and Bordeaux, where you would walk through the field and select vines that both tasted good and looked virus-free, take that plant material and create a new block, a new vineyard parcel to work with. And so what we saw is these three Massal selected blocks are therefore super unique in themselves. And so block one is very red, racy fruit, super gamey, super earthy. It's the most, I would say, classic in regards to this kind of varietal character on the property. Block 18, kind of down the hill, it's warmer spot. It has the most kind of supple tannins, highest fruit concentration, more a little bit more modern ripe in style. And at the very top of the ranch, which is kind of right by Los Niños, the original old vine block, just down the hill a bit, 54 is the most black-fruited, highest acidity, firmest tannins, most robust, kind of mountain-esque Cabernet. And so what this project really is about is trying to call back the heritage of Monterosso and the Martini family. And really the idea of wine is truly a piece of food culture from a place. It's not just a drink. And so this wine should always pay homage to that philosophy. And so I most recently have been playing with 54 and 1 as kind of the base selections here because they complement each other perfectly. 54 brings tannin, 1 brings the fragrance. And so I'm playing with proportions there with E50, the Los Niños block as some base wine. And we found a pretty fantastic combination of this kind of terroir idea through these different personalities to get there. Same thing, Monterosso, similar to the Zin, Monterosso has very, very high acidity. Something special about that vineyard in the old vines is it does get through the phenological processes fairly quickly, but it always retains high acidity. So the Zinfandel and the Cabernet are miles past the acidity level that you'd normally see in Napa Valley. And so you do get more classic interpretations of the wine because of that framework. And same thing with the Zin, less new oak these days, all barrique though, standard barrel size. No funky formats yet, a mix of different cooperages used. But we want these two wines to kind of really showcase terroir for sure as we move forward with these, this portfolio.
Yeah, for me, I always kind of say, you know, every year we do kind of a Monterosso tasting. We invite those that also purchase off the vineyard. And I say, like, when you try these wines, even against other people using this, the idea of great terroir, of a great site, it really showcases why this vineyard is so famous because when you exhale on this cab, it is, I can see like the dusty red soil. I have like a baking spice, a little cardamom, a little cinnamon. It's almost sweet on exhale. It's a fascinating thing. It comes across even in my mind through the old vintage, you know, and I think it's that acid that you were talking about that allows these wines, whether they're Zinfandel, the Cabernet, hell, or Barbera, that you can still drink from the 60s, 70s, 80s. They're still showing extremely well, even though Barbera is not supposed to last this long. That's not really its job, but it does because I think that acid is so powerful. Okay, so fourth wine, last wine, is Lot 1. And Lot 1 is a fascinating kind of backstory, which I kind of learned as I've been integrated here into the winery. You know, the story goes that back in the 40s, Louis P., working for his dad, was trained as a scientist, much more of that kind of mentality. I always kind of say he was doing the good Burgundian monk model. He was taking copious notes, as he should, against the vineyard, against which, what was planting where and why and what. And again, it was a very kind of like traditional based kind of approach to like tracking soil to grape to process, right, to kind of fine tune. But he was doing that largely just for himself, but he would make these little annotations on, the story goes, on the barrels themselves, on the foudres, let's say, and say like, I found this interesting, was kind of the language. And the story goes, Frank Schoenmacher from New York, importer and distributor and wine writer, was in visiting, because back in the day, you would sell often barrels in large formats, and then they would bottle it under their name. It was a lot of bulk and custom going on back then. And so Frank came in and was like, well, wait, why aren't you bottling these separate? They're fantastic, you know? And he kind of just shrugged him off and said, I don't know. I mean, I don't, you know. You gotta remember also early 40s, we're still doing Hardy Burgundy and Chablis. Yeah. So he kind of just keeps doing what he's doing. And when, starting in the 60s, he finally kind of took Frank's advice. And you will now notice on some of our bottles, he would take those same lots that he was tracking, but single bottle them, which is unbelievable if you think about it, right? And in mid-60s, let's say, you're seeing a Monterosso Cabernet Sauvignon lot 1, lot 2, lot 27. I think I've found like a lot 58 or something crazy like that. And he kind of kept that practice running really against Monterosso, specifically with the Cabernet, kind of through the 60s and 70s, it kind of seems,
for sure.
Looking back. And then Mike Martini comes along. Do you want to continue the story?
Yeah, so that's this classic rebellious son nature. My dad did something cool, I'm going to change it. And so you have Louis P. making all these skew decisions to bottle, and then you know Mike coming in and trying to use that same premise and perhaps go a step further, which is to say, can we create the ultimate expression of the vintage with this, with one wine instead of 30 whatever wines? And so he, you know, when we built the brand new, what we call micro winery, so the boutique winery, with all these open top tanks to kind of really focus on the craft, that became kind of the studio for potential lot one identities. And so the way that they would continue this is we'd go through the vintage and maybe 1% or less or 5% or less of your inventory would be so intriguing, would be, just so good that you would market as a potential for lot one, this new interpretation of now a one product from many. And what that meant is, you know, we might have five or so different fermenters or different vineyards that were classified that way, and then the work would begin. And so we would work on this wine blind to try and find this sense of awe from the many parts make one whole. Kind of a classic community story, I guess. We're all part of something greater. And so this concept that we can make this blend, we would work on this for about a year or so, iterating, making sure we're reaching this idea of excellence, and until we found something that we were comfortable calling lot one. And so really for the last 23-ish years, that has been the contemporary version of Lot 1 today. So that's what we have in the market. We have a single wine blended from different sites. And what this has evolved into is starting to notice that there are these yin and yang pairings, you know, like sometimes like Viter might require for this wine a pairing from something from Southern Napa or for Calistoga. And so we started seeing that how can we craft something that has this kind of seamless Cabernet personality. Whereas, of course, Monterosso is very much about the personification of place. This, we want to have that the next level of art overlaid on top of the place of Napa Valley. So a little bit more, you know, winemaking passion, I suppose. And that is kind of, that's where we stay today. So it is a bit more robust in that sense. We do want this wine to live many, many years in the future. So we are looking at tannins and acidity as well. But because of the way this is made, it tends to have a little bit higher oak percentage. It's sometimes a little bit more supple on the mouth, and that helps us kind of capture that seamless mouthfeel.
Yeah, I think the thing that makes this wine also really fascinating, so one, it's 100% Cabernet, whereas like Griffin will have blenders in it, and is kind of like, again, this interpretation, and I think Lot 1 has always been 100% Cabernet and always will. And it is interesting how certain years are kind of what we kind of call mountain years, and then certain years are a little more valley years. And over the 20-some years that this program's been running, you know, those kind of ebb and flow depending on what's happening for that year, which I think is really kind of interesting. But again, it's always this kind of idea of, I always, again, back to like visualizing, whenever I take a sip of this, I always kind of almost imagined like a layered cake. Yeah. And there's these different kind of components almost. And it's, and I, you know, I always kind of describe it as, there's about that 80%, right, the base, and then there's a bit of the spice rack of what can I bring in? I want a little more blueberry, I want some slate, I need, you know, like those components that feel like are kind of important is what I think makes this wine. I always describe this wine to somms as, this is an option for you for that table that want to share one bottle, but their the meal is all over the place. Yeah. And normally, when I, you know, back in the day, I'd be like, do you like Pinot Noir? How do you feel about a really interesting, you know, Burgundy? Because it's kind of fits in the middle ground. And I was like, I think the flex move is a wine like this, because no one's expecting Cabernet to pair with salmon or tuna, but we've had it, you and I have both had it here, and it can go with so many things. And I think it is kind of a testament to the blend and the quality of craftsmanship.
Right on.
Okay, so those are the four wines. As I said, you know, we basically have had a lot of change happen, you know, at Martini over the last few years. Because, and kind of going back to that first wine, the Griffin, because of the new philosophy that Zach's kind of brought to the winemaking, effectively all the wine that comes in that's either Cabernet or Cab-centric is there really to make now the Griffin.
Yeah.
And then we are kind of taking exceptional lots, if you will, and pulling them out to do our single vineyards or do Lot 1. And so it effectively means, like, the stylistically, you know, this is not just we have one wine in market that's a new style. It's everything is this new approach, because I think for us, we've always believed that, you know, wine is a part of culture and it is a part of the table, and it is about the ability to kind of seamlessly integrate. And we're really trying to find wines and craft wines that widen the aperture of its ability to pair and find relationships, so that, again, you can bring people together.
For sure. So,
great. Well, thank you. Thank you for listening, and let us know if you have any questions.